broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Welcome to today's podcast. We will be focusing today on nutrition for pressure injury prevention and pressure injury healing. Our podcast today is sponsored by Abbott Nutrition. I'm Joyce Black. I am the host of the podcast today, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska College of Nursing. My guest for today's podcast is Carly Rush, and we'll get to talk to Carly in just a few minutes. If you've been following the podcast, you know that I start with what's in my mailbox. So interesting question today. How do we deal with patients or residents or clients, depending on what practice you have, who are non-compliant? Frustrating problem, isn't it? We teach the patient, family, co-workers, all sorts of people to help the patient get better, and they don't follow our teaching. They do something completely contrary to what we've asked them to do. And it's hard because we see them injure themselves or delay their healing process. We in the U.S. tend to use the word compliant or non-compliant. I'm going to caution you not to use that word. It's a very derogatory word. And I'd rather have you use the word adherence, but I want to caution you a little bit on two things. Number one, I'm a believer that all behaviors have a reason. And I want you to spend some time with this person to try to figure out what's driving the behavior. What is causing them to not want to eat, to not want to turn off of the pressure injury, to not want to go to physical therapy? Once you find that reason, you may be able to get better participation. And then the final word of caution is be very careful that you don't classify a person with dementia or delirium as a non-adherent or non-compliant person, because they don't have the mental capacity to understand that if they're not eating or drinking their oral supplementation, it's going to harm them. They don't have that capacity. So if you are a mother of teenagers, you've been down this road, you have preached and preached to your kids not to do something and they do it anyway, they probably have the capacity to understand. They just choose to not listen to you. That's not true with the patient with dementia. You need to reach out to the family and try to explain what's going on. So that's what was in my mailbox this week. I thought it was an interesting topic. I'm going to turn now to my guest for today and introduce you to Carly Rush. Carly, thank you for being part of today's podcast. Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Black. So my name is Carly Rush. I am a medical science liaison in medical affairs and research at Abbott. I specialize in adult therapeutic nutrition. And just for awareness, my team, we're comprised of clinical scientists. We support research education programs on behalf of Abbott. And a little bit more about my background, I am a PhD RD, so I'm a dietitian by training. I did all of my education at the University of Florida, so go Gators. And during my PhD training, I focused a lot as it relates to nutrition, metabolism. I also taught courses on nutrition, metabolism, research methods. So probably in today's podcast, you might hear me really emphasize the importance of the underlying pathophysiology of nutrition, because I just find it so fascinating. And I'm very passionate about educating others too. As a dietitian, I used to practice inpatient. So many times I would encounter patients with pressure injuries and really trying to establish nutrition interventions to help support their healing process. So very excited to be chatting with you here today on the timely topic of nutrition and pressure injuries.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I think you've come to the right place and we have the right speaker. So before I get into the meat of the matter, I want to tell the audience a common analogy I have when I think about how pressure injuries heal. Now, Carly, being from Florida, probably doesn't have a lot of cows to milk, but me being in Nebraska, there's more cows in Nebraska than there are people. Now, they're not all milking cows, but here's the analogy. I use the analogy of a three-legged stool. And if you take a leg off the stool, it doesn't stay up. This, the same three legs apply to healing pressure injuries. Here's the legs. The first leg of the stool, the most important leg of the stool, is to fix the problem. The problem of pressure injuries is pressure. So get the patient off of the wound. If they're laying on the pressure injury, it's not going to get any better. The second leg of the stool is nutrition. They have to have more protein and calories. The body can't heal if the body's not getting the adequate protein and calories. And I think you're going to hear a lot of that from Carly. And the third leg of the stool is what we put on the wound to keep it from getting infected. That's the least important leg. And as a nurse, that's probably the leg you spend the most time on. I want to direct you back up to the middle leg. That's the leg of nutrition. So tell us in a nutshell, Carly, why is nutrition so important? And to our audience, how can we make them pay more attention to it themselves and maybe rely less on the nutritionist? Because that's what I hear. Well, the dietitian's going to take care of that. The nutritionist is going to take care of that. What would you tell them if you're standing next to me at the bedside?
Yeah. Well, I would tell them that it's everyone's job to take care of nutrition, right? It's not just the dietitian's job. Sure, we can inform as dietitians on the appropriate amount of calories, protein, micronutrients that are involved to support that patient's healing process. But it's everyone's job to ensure that the patient maybe have access to the right support, education, promoting adherence to. There's so many things that happen, whether during a hospital admission, long-term care, skilled nursing, even at home, right? There's so many different ways that nurses, other providers can just really jump in and ask patients, you know, how is eating going for you? How are you doing supporting your nutrition, the food that you're eating during this process, right? And that's where dietitians can come in to really fine tune. But to answer your question on why does really nutrition matter? Well, it's because it's the foundation, to your point, it's the middle leg. It's supporting all the phases of the wound healing process, right? So we have those three overlapping phases, the inflammatory phase where we have that increased production of immune cells, messaging molecules to go to the wound site and really help initiate that healing process. But patients need to move into that proliferation phase too. And that's where we have cells like our fibroblasts, right? Depositing collagen into the wound bed environment. And then that maturation phase too, to really create that stronger tissue strength. And nutrition supports all of those phases. And as we go through today, I'll kind of highlight, you know, at what point it does. But when it comes to energy and protein, to your point, that's supporting all of the phases of wound healing. We know that, especially with chronic wounds like pressure injuries, many patients can get stuck in that inflammatory phase. And that can be really quite taxing on the body. It could increase metabolic demands, meaning that patients need to eat more calories to support creating new cells, new proteins. And we know that there are extrinsic and intrinsic factors involved in wound healing, and nutrition is one of the more modifiable ones.
So when we talk about modifiable risk factors, nutrition is a big one, because you think me and you, we could have a croissant and raspberry jam in front of us and we would just eat it and keep talking, right? The jam would be running out of our mouth and we would keep talking. But what I hear from patients in the hospital all of the time is, oh, I don't feel like eating. I'm in too much pain to eat. I just got told that my tumor's back and it's grade 4 and they don't have anything to do for me. So there's lots of other factors that drive the patient's lack of desire, perhaps, to eat. And that's, I think, what's the hardest part for the medical team to try to say, well, I know you have a grade 4 tumor, but you're not going to die this afternoon. So can't you eat this roast beef sandwich? Can't we get that into you? That's a problem. So Carly, what's our approach? What do we do for that patient?
So I would say the first step to that approach is really screening for nutritional risk. When it comes to management of wounds, especially for pressure injuries, we know malnutrition, so getting inadequate calorie and protein in the diet, is a strong contributor to adverse events like pressure injuries. We know malnutrition can also contribute to new falls, right? Which we know can contribute to new wounds. It can increase risk for infections, even reductions in quality of life as well too. So I would say screening for malnutrition risk is going to be the first step. And of course, on admission, normally nutrition risk screening should be done. Ideally, that's usually with the help of our nursing colleagues, other staff too, but sometimes dietitians or other diet techs may also be the ones to jump in and perform that nutrition risk screening. And once we've identified those at risk or those with malnutrition, right, which have been hopefully identified by a dietitian assessment, that's when we can really start creating those targeted interventions too. So the first one would be providing enough energy support for those patients. I mentioned earlier how insufficient energy can really impair that wound healing process with all the phases of wound healing. And when not enough energy is available, the body will start breaking down other sources to provide that quick energy. And oftentimes it's proteins in specific, which can compromise muscle health. So in the 2019 international guidelines, it is recommended that for those with a pressure injury and who is at risk or with malnutrition, patients should be getting somewhere between 30 to 35 calories per kilogram of body weight per day. And I know sometimes for some clinicians, they don't always think about calories in that type of perspective, right? So I always like to use my 70 kilogram male as an example. So at a minimum, for 30 calories per kilogram per day, that would be around 2,100 calories per day that they would need.
Oh, that's much easier to think about, because I have to admit, you know, how was it 20, 30 years ago we tried to go to the metric system? Holy cow, I still look at things in pounds and I still drive in miles per hour. But when you say 2,000 or 2,100 calories a day, that's easier for me to think about. So in the patient with pressure injuries, is it mostly a lack of protein that we're dealing with, or mostly a lack of carbohydrate, or is it a combination of those? You know, if the patient's only willing to eat for 3 bites or 4 bites, what should those bites consist of?
No, that's a great point. So really, I would say being very protein forward with the approach too. When I used to practice, I actually used to practice in oncology, and they were always at high risk of developing various related wounds, including pressure injuries. And I always said, you know, you only get so many bites a day, so you really want to make it count, right? And so protein should be in every single bite. And we know protein's important because it supports the repair of those body tissues. And when it comes to what's that main organ that drives that metabolic health and protein turnover, it's the muscle, right? So oftentimes, especially when we think of patients with limited mobility, right, we do see a decline in muscle mass, especially as mobility declines too. So protein is going to be very important, not only for just the wound site healing, but also protecting muscle health. And we know with protein that the guidelines from the 2019 guidelines do recommend between 1.25 to 1.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And if we use our same example, so about 150 pound man, that would be about, I believe it's about somewhere in like the 85 grams of protein per day range.
So give me an example of 85 grams of protein. Is that 8 ounces of a hamburger? What would that be?
I could give you an example where around 3 ounces of chicken is about 25 grams of protein.
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you a quick story, just to, the reason I'm drilling down so hard. We had a meeting at the hospital with all of our clinical staff, and we kept saying to, these are our nurses' aides and our care techs, be sure when the patient asks for something to eat, you offer protein to them. And so they said to us, what in the refrigerator would be protein? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, we have ice cream, so that would kind of be protein. We have Italian ice. We have sherbet. We have 7-Up. We have hang on, guys. What do we have in the refrigerator that's protein? And so every time I hear this example of offer protein to the patient, our refrigerators in the hospital don't have much. So thank you for your clear example of 3 ounces of chicken. That's a very clear example to me. I can see that in my head is 25 grams of protein. So now when I talk to my techs and aides, I can give them more to work with as far as teaching or helping the patient. That's a great example. I thank you.
And something to think about too is the pattern that patients consume protein throughout the day. So when we think of the typical American diet, or even in other countries too, oftentimes we eat more protein at one meal than the other meal, right? For example, in the United States, I know we oftentimes eat a majority of our protein in dinner time too. So even thinking about, you know, what are other strategies to improve protein intake earlier in the day or between meals too, especially when we're thinking about the patient with poor oral intake and just unable to consume very many bites at a meal too.
So you would advocate for eggs with breakfast and not cereal and toast. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
If it's palatable and within someone's diet, absolutely can be a wonderful source of protein.
Yeah. Being coming from the farm, eggs was a common source of protein for me. So that one will fit real well here in the middle of the country. So what's your advice to the average nurse doctor at the bedside? We find in the medical record that our nutritionists write these very elaborate notes where they calculate the basal energy expenditure and they calculate the ideal calories and protein a day and what the recommendation is. And it's easy to skip those. I'll testify under oath. It's easy to skip those and go right over and think about what I'm doing. So what's your advice? How do I make that middle leg of the stool come to life for people at the bedside with patients in all settings? They're not always there when we're doing care. How do we make your notes come up in neon or something where we see them?
Yeah. So I would say the first strategy is if you don't have a relationship with your dietitian, make a relationship happen, right? You're right. Sometimes because we are covering multiple units, multiple floors, if you're practicing in a skilled nursing facility, right? That dietitian may only come a couple times, maybe once a month to actually see the patients that you're treating. So I would say first is just figuring out who is the dietitian that supports and see if there are opportunities to develop relationships with them. Do you have any skin committees, right? Or are you rounding, discussing wound healing and the nutrition status of your patient? Is the dietitian involved? If they're not, can we get them involved, right? Sometimes with dietitians, it's just extending the invitation because we might not even be aware that it's happening, right? So that would be one step. Obviously, aligning to the SPIP checklist is another great place to start too. So that standardized pressure injury prevention protocol. At the bottom of the checklist, they really highlight the importance of nutrition and dietitian consultation. One of the things I always ask my bedside nurses, even wound care nurses, to think about is once you've identified that pressure injury, right, or maybe some skin breakdown that you haven't really diagnosed it yet, while you're consulting the wound care team to come in, think about, can you create a nutrition consult too that can get the dietitian to the forefront? If you are the wound care nurse, just seeing, has nutrition been consulted? Maybe you don't have time to read through all of the notes, but just figuring out, are they on board, right? Those are some really great places to start bringing that nutrition to the forefront of the conversation.
Those are excellent pieces of advice. I have been fortunate my whole career to work with very engaged nutritionists. They sit on our wound committee. They consult and round every day in critical care with us. And as probably every hospital, every critical care unit in the US, we used to wait forever to feed people in critical care. I don't know what we were doing. Their metabolic rate had probably tripled due to their infection. And we stood around and waited for some magic time to pass before we would feed them parenterally. Now the nutritionist is on our case. We need to feed them today. Why can't we get them fed today? And so we do a lot more aggressive nutrition, and it's totally because the nutritionist is on the team. And so I'm 100% in support of nutritional services. And I think for those of you that don't have an active relationship with your nutritionist in your setting, Carly's right. You need to get one. And if you're seeing, and I presume you're going to agree with me, if you're seeing a patient not healing, you've got to start thinking about how much protein is being drained out of that wound every day. If you're seeing a patient losing weight, losing muscle mass, not performing in PT, you got to think about nutrition being the common denominator to those problems and get nutrition on board. Last thoughts, Carly, before we sign off this excellent podcast. This was simply excellent.
Yes. So I would say one of the things that we didn't get to discuss and something to keep in mind too, especially for those patients that struggle to get enough nutrition, is oftentimes dietitians, other providers may recommend an oral nutrition supplement to help fill in the gaps when patients are unable to meet their oral intake for calories and protein, right? So those can be other strategies as well to make sure that patients are consuming enough throughout the day. Maybe you are the bedside nurse, you see something, a product or a supplement on their bedside, right? Even just promoting adherence to it. Hey, I see that you haven't drank that today. You know, how about we do that and go for a walk around the unit? Something else to keep in mind too is that those with stage 2 and greater pressure injuries at risk of malnutrition, we talked a lot about protein and calories, but these patients may also be deficient in other micronutrients too, whether it be arginine, glutamine, zinc, and other antioxidants like vitamin C and E. And there have been research to support how additional supplementation of arginine, glutamine, and other nutrients can benefit that wound healing process for a stage 2 or greater pressure injury. And that's also recommended as part of the international guidelines too. So something to keep in mind, not just calories and protein, but are they getting enough micronutrient support as well?
Yeah, those are excellent pieces of advice. When in the day would you suggest the supplements be given? Like here we go with the story again. In the hospital, they come up at the same time as the meals. And so the patient is looking at, they like that supplement. It tastes better than the food. And so they drink the supplement and then they don't eat the food. Uh-huh. And so we struggle a little bit. What would be your advice? Should they be done after breakfast, middle of the morning, middle of the afternoon, before bedtime? Is that what you, so we go to 6 meals a day, 3 meals, 3 supplements. How would you dose that?
Absolutely. So it's definitely going to be patient driven, right? There's going to be a very individualization of what is going to work for that person. I think a great place to start, because of course we want to promote food first, right? We want to make sure that patients are able to consume enough calories and protein through their diet. And when that is unable, they're unable to achieve that, I think it's definitely reasonable in between meals, providing that oral nutrition support, because it is a liquid. It's less likely to stay on their stomach as long as eating a full meal, right? So that can be one strategy. If you're finding that your patient's just struggling to do that in between meals and they just really struggle at mealtime, then maybe it will be appropriate, at least in the acute setting, the acute period of time, to promote that ONS at a mealtime too, in addition to food. I would say just listen to your patient and what works for them. But definitely, I think a great strategy is starting in between meals throughout the day.
Well, thank you. This was simply an excellent podcast. I thank you for joining, listening to Carly Rush talk about all the benefits of nutrition. It seems obvious to me. It seems obvious. I think sometimes as practitioners, we get so focused on the wound that we forget the body has to heal the wound. And if we support the body with adequate nutrition, that's more likely to happen. So this is Joyce Black signing off our podcast on the role of nutrition in the healing and prevention of pressure injuries. I want to thank Courtney Smith, the executive of this process with the University of Nebraska and the RN Huddle process, for supporting the podcast efforts. And I'll see you next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.